Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I gotta call my girlfriend. Oh my God, I'm having a baby. No, that I don't even know what that is.
Hello and welcome to Varvet International. This is Christopher Triumph and you're listening to episode 40. And if that number calls for a celebration, we have the perfect guest for it, as Jerry Ferrara is in the house. Or he was in the house. This was recorded some time ago in Los Angeles. As you will hear, we're in West Hollywood. Jerry Ferrara is 35 years old and he was born and raised in Brooklyn, New York. He's been a working actor for 15 years or so, but it was with the role as Turtle on the incredible hit TV show Entourage that he got a true breakthrough as an actor, and world fame came with it. When I met Jerry, he was sort of done with all the press around the Entourage movie that had hit the cinemas this spring, and I can only imagine how tired he must be of talking about the Entourage thing. So I'll make him talk about it even more. And he did. Such an extremely nice guy. We'll touch base also on his own podcast. He actually has two, Bad for Business and Bad for Sports. Check them out. Both available on iTunes and Acast, I think. But enough with the background. Let's dig into the much anticipated Jerry Ferrara interview. Roll the tape, please. We were just discussing that you were so punctual.
You know, actually, Starbucks held me up. I would have been here probably down to the minute.
Okay, yeah, but that's perfect.
Yeah, I don't know when that happened because I was not always a... It's not that I was like a irresponsible guy, but there was always like a 15-minute buffer of lateness with me. And just something happened as I got closer to 30. I just cannot be... Like, it'll drive me nuts if I'm 15, 20 minutes late. I don't know why.
That's very nice.
Yes. But now the problem is, like, if someone does it to me, I get mad.
I heard them discuss this on NPR yesterday, that parents should help their kids up to a point, but then if the kid fails at, like, being on time or something like that, that they should stop helping.
And let them figure it out?
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good strategy. I think it works best because, you know, your parents can only take you so far into, like, telling you what to do and how to do it. But yeah, I was late all the time when I was younger,
yeah,
when I was a kid, but yeah, I just figured it out.
Being a professional actor and so forth, is that, do you have to be on time?
Yeah, you know, and that's pretty much how I learned my lesson. I was really late one day, inadvertently. I didn't do it on my alarm clock, just didn't go off, and I had like a 6 a.m. call time. And I woke up at 7:30,
mm-hmm,
and I still had traffic to battle. So I was probably, I think that's also what, like, I set two alarms now. I put one across the room, so I have to physically get up. But yeah, you know, because on a set in production, that's money. You know, if you're an hour late, if you broke it down to by the hour, how much it costs to shoot something, it's a very costly hour. And I just think it's disrespectful.
Of course.
To keep, especially in production, if you left 80 people standing around waiting for you, I just think that's very disrespectful. So I do my best.
How are you today?
I'm good today. Real good. I actually used to live right over here, so this is kind of like a cool little flashback. I walked into my old coffee shop and...
And they spelt your name right.
Let's see. Yeah, you know what? Sometimes I get Jerry with a G. Sometimes I get J-E-R-R-I. So I get a few different... Sometimes I just get Jared. They just hear something different.
You know that they have a strategy around that, right?
Which is?
That if they spell your name really wrong, you're going to Instagram it, and then they're going to get exposure.
I've actually done that. Yeah, I've done that. I've actually Instagrammed the wrong spelling.
Yeah.
I always thought, though, too, like, I wrote this short film one time, which I never shot, which maybe I'll shoot one day, about a guy who finds out his girlfriend is cheating on him via the names on a Starbucks coffee cup. She said she was with her girlfriend, mm-hmm. and then he looked at her Starbucks cup and it said, like, Jake on it.
Okay, yeah. Yeah,
yeah. Starbucks, what are you going to do? Taking over the world.
Can I ask you, I mean, this is my second language, obviously. Can I ask you, should I call you sir?
No, no.
I shouldn't?
No.
Because I'm 5 years older than you are. Should you call me sir?
I think like 5 years is about the same. So you're almost 40 or you are 40?
41.
I think we're about the same. I think when you get past 30, anything within 5 years, we're basically the same age. Like, okay. I feel like we're experiencing a lot of the same things. So no, I think there's got to be, like, at least here, I think it's like 15 years.
Okay.
A senior to call someone sir. I got called sir for the first time the other night, and it was, I kind of liked it, I'm not going to lie.
Yeah, you did?
Yeah, it's like an 18-year-old kid working at a restaurant. As we were finishing, he came up to me and said, "Excuse me, sir." And I looked at him, I looked around trying to figure out who he was talking to. And he's like, "Would you mind?" He's like, "I'm a big fan of Entourage. Do you mind if we get a picture after you leave?" And I said, "Sure." Very respectful young man. And as I was leaving, after I took the picture, he called me Mr. Ferrara. So I really felt like an accomplished older gentleman.
Okay. You have to get used to it.
I love it. I mean, outside of, like, my body physically not being able to do the things it used to do, I'm enjoying the aging process. I really am. I like that my hair is turning gray. I like that I'm getting some, like, laugh line wrinkles. I like complaining that I'm old. It's the greatest excuse to go home early.
Has your physique started to sort of give up on you?
It's starting to a little. Like, there's just, I actually, knock on wood, I'm in pretty decent shape.
I can tell.
And I think it's because all my 20s, I was in such bad shape. I kind of took my 20s off and just destroyed myself in terms of food. And, you know, I used to smoke a lot of cigarettes and I used to smoke a lot of pot. So I started getting in shape basically on my 30th birthday. So, but now, yeah, like the knees, I have a knee thing. I have a hip thing.
Me too.
I have like a lower back thing. I get like this weird, like my foot falls asleep very easily. I have like some sciatic nerve thing. Okay. It's all falling apart.
I have the hip thing too, and I'm trying to run, but I can't anymore. So
that's the thing. Running outside, running on like we got you and I. We need to do like elliptical machines because there's no impact on the knees and the hips. That's what we have to do.
And you can do that somewhere.
The gym, the place I hate and love. The gym.
Okay. How often do you go?
I used to go a lot. I used to be like a 5 day a week guy. I kind of hit a wall. Now I try to go like 3 times a week and then do a day or two of an activity, whether it's basketball or a hike or a swim, just something where I'm not like in a gym with my iPod, my music in and running while staring into space, you know? Yeah.
So you don't run like marathons and so forth?
No, I actually would love to do that one day. It's been a goal of mine. But again, like we were saying, I don't actually know. I'm sure if I trained, I could probably do it. But I think it would be really taxing on the ankles and knees to do it. I marvel at people who train. I'm a goal-oriented person. Like, yeah. I need to know what the light at the end of the tunnel is. So training for something like a marathon would be great. But to just train for no reason, I have a hard time. I need a goal.
So do you have a goal right now?
You know, I don't. And I think that's kind of the reason why I'm struggling a little bit right now. I'm certainly not training and working out and being as active as I am. Basketball, I have a goal. I'm playing in, it's called Fantasy Camp. This is like the nerdiest thing for a quote unquote athletic person to do. You basically, and it's done through the USA Olympic basketball team. It's a camp in Vegas, okay, where they take a bunch of old, not so athletic guys like myself, and you pretend like you're a professional athlete for 3 days. They give you real coaches, they give you the real jerseys, you play in real games with referees in front of a crowd. So it's a fantasy camp. You pretend like you're a professional athlete for 3 days.
Okay.
So I'm training for that right now, which is cool. But when I have no goals, I do the most half-assed workouts in the world.
That sounds like a fantastic thing, though. Is it for all sports or just...
I think the main one is football. They do it with baseball as well.
Okay.
But basketball is like the one. A lot of professional, like LeBron James and Dwayne, where they have like their own where all the proceeds go to charity, usually tied to a great charity.
Okay.
Because they're expensive, these camps.
Yeah, so you had to pay to get into it.
Yeah, yeah, but it's all charity-based. Okay. So.
We've sort of touched base on many things that I would like to discuss with you later on. But
sure.
I was going to ask you, you said that you used to live near here.
Yes, I used to live very close to here.
Where do you live now?
I moved basically kind of close to like Century City, just past like Beverly Hills. I guess it's close to Beverly Hills, but we're just outside the zip code. So that 90210 zip code increases your bills quite a lot. So yeah. I'm very close, but I used to walk this street every day.
Okay.
To get
Santa Monica.
Yeah, just to get my coffee. All my errands were like right along this strip.
So do you live technically in the valley?
No. I'm okay. Still on this side of the hill, as okay. They like to say. But I lived in the valley for first 8 years when I moved to LA. I'm from New York originally, so I did an 8-year bid in the valley.
Okay.
Which I feel like a lot of people do when they move to LA, because the valley's very nice, almost suburban, but it's way more reasonable place to live for a young, struggling actor, and a lot of great restaurants you can work at as well. And it's not that far. I mean, traffic could be a nightmare, but I always liked the valley because I wanted to stay out of trouble. I did not want to be in the scene. I wanted to be outside the scene when I was younger. Just because I wanted to stay focused. I wanted to, you know, the reason why I came here was to chase my career, or otherwise I would have never left. I have a great family in New York, great friends, and New York is one of the best places to party if that's what you wanted to do. So if I left that for a career, then damn sure that was going to be my number one priority. I mean, I still had fun, don't get me wrong, but it was like my security blanket where I was just far enough away from the scene, quote.
Someone told me also that like North Hollywood is really happening right now and so forth.
Yeah, it is. It's kind of, I guess you could almost say in a weird way, it's like the Williamsburg of LA. North Hollywood always had like its own kind of arts district. And North Hollywood was one of those places where, you know, you could be in one part of it where it's really nice and suburban, then you cross the street and then it's kind of like a hairy area where you're like, whoa, where am I? But yeah, no, a lot of it's become a really popular place in the valley to live. There's a lot to do. That's the problem with the valley is, you know, after 9 p.m., there's not a whole lot to do. Whereas in the 80s, Ventura Boulevard, all throughout like Sherman Oaks and Studio City, was actually a very happening place. Now, North Hollywood's kind of has like a nice kind of nightlife art kind of district. We actually did an episode years ago of Entourage where we had to go to the valley. And all the reasons why you don't want to go to the valley is what we were complaining. It's one of our more popular episodes.
Yeah, I remember
the
that.
Valley episode. Yeah.
In order to understand you, what do I need to know about Brooklyn?
You need to know that it was a great place for a kid to grow up. You have to grow up kind of fast over there because it was a pretty rough neighborhood where even sometimes like the innocent got caught up in some rough stuff, you know. But it was just a very impressionable place. You know, when I grew up in Brooklyn, it was kind of dominated by gangsters in a way, you know, like in the quote unquote, I'm not gonna say the mafia because there is no such thing, that's what we were taught, you know.
Okay.
But it just was a very, like, they were like movie stars in our neighborhood because they had money and cars and women. So it's a very impressionable place to grow up in, which is why I think I learned early on that you got to stay out of trouble and like kind of mind your business and do your own thing and be an individual. Don't follow the crowd. But like I said, it was the kind of place where you grew up and your best friends lived on the same street as you, and you know, you didn't have to like call to see what was going on. You just walked down to the avenue, like if Santa Monica Boulevard was our popular, you just Saturday mornings I woke up, I just go down there and 15 of my best friends were just there. We were playing football, basketball, or getting into some mischief. It really was a great place to grow up, and I guess that's where the term like street smarts, I guess, is kind of invented, you know?
Which part of Brooklyn is this?
Bensonhurst, Brooklyn, which is right in between Bay Ridge and Dyker Heights, which Bay Ridge is kind of, I guess you would say, if it was LA, it was like our Sunset Boulevard. It's like where you went for all your nightlife and the restaurants and the bars. And Diker Heights was the very that's not suburban, but it's where all the big houses were. Like if you had money and you lived in Diker Heights.
Okay.
Bensonhurst, you know, it was a Irish, Italian, Catholic community sprinkled in with, like I said, it was almost like everyone kind of stuck to their own. Then there was a Jewish community. Then there was a Hispanic community. And like, it almost was like the movie The Warriors. Everyone had their own territory almost. Now it's completely different. Brooklyn's become like a very trendy, cool place to live. But when I was growing up, the areas now that are so expensive and desired to live in, those are like bad areas. Like, yeah, you didn't go in there unless you were up to no good.
Do you know that Williamsburg now is like 99% Swedish?
Is that right?
No.
I was about to say, that is a great stat. I don't know if that's true. I wish you could have listening. If you saw my face, you would know I was not fooled by that.
No.
But it caught me off guard.
No, but the thing is that there's a lot of Swedes there.
Yeah, there's a lot of everyone there.
Well, of
you
course.
Know?
Yeah.
It's definitely a big, giant melting pot, which is what makes it so cool because you have so many different cultures that are influencing. I mean, it really is. It feels like you're on another planet almost.
I heard you say perhaps on your own podcast or something that you want to live here in LA now, but would you consider moving back at some point?
I think about it every day.
Oh,
and
you do?
Even more so now, you know, I've had a girlfriend for a while and I definitely see the future with her, and I, you know, 35 years old, I would like to, you know, have kids in the relative near future. And you know, I think about growing kids up in LA, and it's not that I don't want to do that. It's just, you know, I have nieces and nephews, my brother, my cousins, everyone's there, and that's how I grew up. I was surrounded by them, and I feel like I would want my kids to be surrounded by their family and their mom's family, obviously. So I think about it all the time, but those winters creep into your mind.
Yeah,
that's where it kind of really influences you, because I also love the fact that you get to be completely active November through April. That is what makes LA unique and special, more so than anywhere, is the weather. I know you hear about it all the time. It really is a game changer for me. Like, I get depressed in the winter on the East Coast. When I'm in the house too long, I really start to slip into a depression.
Welcome to Sweden. Our summer is like 2 months.
Really? How bad is the winter, though?
That's 10 months of winter. It is bad.
But I'm sure the winter's there, though, even though the weather's freezing cold. Probably still very beautiful, though.
Yes, it can be, absolutely. But I'm living in Stockholm, mm-hmm, and it's like New York in a way, because when the snow falls, it's going to be beautiful for like one hour.
And then
it's like slush and...
Yeah, the cars start trudging through it, and the dogs get a hold of it.
Exactly. But it sounds like you were sort of middle class growing up, or...
Probably a little below that.
Okay, working class even.
Yeah, certainly. I was raised by a single mother. My father passed away when I was 5. My older brother was 8 or 9. You know, my dad was 36, which is weird. I'm going on a tangent, but I was discussing this with a friend of mine whose father passed away at a young age too. And it's almost like this ticking clock, because I'm 35. And I have it down to the number, like my dad was 36 years old and 2 months, mm-hmm, when he passed away. So for me, January of 2016, I will have outlived my father. And I thought, what a morbid thing to think of. And then I had told my brother about it. He's like, oh yeah, I did the same thing, because he's older. He passed like a few years. He passed my dad age-wise. And I was talking to another one of my friends who I think just turned 40. He's like, yeah, I outlived my father. Apparently, this is something that a lot of men do if their fathers passed away young. You want to like it's almost like a relief once you pass that threshold. So I thought that was a little...
Of course.
I thought I was the only one who was doing that, and I thought I was very weird for doing it. Anyway, not trying to bring the mood down in the room.
No, but
so when he passed away, you know, we didn't have much. So I'm not going to say that we were poor, but we basically had everything we needed, but that's it. Mm-hmm. There was nothing extra, you know. There was no cool Jordans on your feet. There was no, like, I didn't get to go to the school all my friends went to because it was like $5,000 a year at the time, which now is nothing. Schools are $50,000 a year. I didn't have like the cool basketball jersey, but in the same breath, I wasn't walking around with holes in my shoes and stuff. And my mom was a school crossing guard, and it was at the Catholic school right next to the school I went to. And she basically got that job, so she had the same hours as my brother and I. And she didn't make much money, but they had amazing health benefits. The city had great health benefits. And she always said that's what, like, kept us afloat, was the fact that all those benefits were covered by the city. That's why she worked the job so long.
And who were you in school? Were you the class clown or?
No, I was the class blend-in guy. I mean, I guess you could say I was kind of popular. Like, I kind of walked amongst every group. Like, I never fancied myself like one of the cool kids, because I liked hanging out with the slightly nerdier kids. Like, we'd play Dungeons and Dragons and Ninja Turtles and all that stuff. But I was like, I'm not going to say I was a jock because I'm not physically gifted, but I loved sports so much, so I'd hang out with the jock type guys. Always hung out with the girls. Like, I had more, like, better girlfriends sometimes than guy friends. I kind of, that's why I say I blended. I was cool with every different type of crew in school, but yet I never really stood out. I just blended in, and I kind of love that, and I still try to do that. Yeah. I didn't pick the right profession for that, but yeah, I guess I blended in. Like, if you asked any of my teachers probably in junior high or even high school, like, hey, do you remember Jerry Ferrara? They'd probably go, nope, never heard of him.
Okay. I actually wrote this down, that my guess is that you've never been bullied.
No, I actually, you know, I've never been bullied. I've seen a lot of bullying, and it was always very heartbreaking to me. I never quite understood it. I never participated in it. I usually would stand up for the one being bullied as best I can, although I was not very big, so it'd be hard for me to fend off. But I actually saw the craziest thing. A kid in my, I don't know what grade it was, maybe he was fifth grade. I'm talking, this guy was the biggest kid in school. He was probably 6'2". At like whatever, 10 years old. And he, there was something, when I say off, I'm not talking about any kind of like major thing, but he was certainly socially awkward. He was a gang, like, you could tell he was uncomfortable with the size of his body. And this was the guy that everyone bullied. And I knew right away, I said, this is gonna go horribly wrong one day. This guy, I mean, it's basically like the Terminator. You guys are bullying the Terminator. If this kid snaps, and sure enough, one day, he was getting bullied real bad, and I tried to even interject, and this kid lost it and just started, like, physically beating kids. I mean, kids were getting tossed across the room. it looked like something out of professional wrestling. And a lot of kids learned their lesson that day, and you wish it wouldn't take something like that. And back then, that was kind of the version of a kid snapping, was usually like an awkward teen or a pre-adolescent fight. Nowadays, it's become, at least in America, far, far worse.
But after that, did they leave him?
No one went near him. Joe Stern was his name. Okay. I just remembered his name.
Are you Facebook friends?
No, that's the thing. I am not, again, I blended it. I am not really friends with anyone from junior high school or high school on Facebook.
You played sports, of course.
That was what my life was about, was sports.
You told me that you were goal-oriented, or that you are. Did you have goals in...
Yeah, I wanted to be a professional basketball player. I picked the one sport where it's essential to be tall. And I mean, if you put a ruler across my brother and my dad and I's forehead, heads, it would be exactly level. We're all 5'7", bare in shoes. And no one in my family played sports. No one cared really about sports except my mom. You know, my mom, and again, the single mom thing, like, I also loved baseball at first. Like, my mom taught me how to throw, which is why, no disrespect, mom, if you're listening, I can't throw to save my life. Like, I throw like a girl, because a girl taught me how to throw. But man, she would go out in the street with me till 9 o'clock at night with the glove, and we'd just play catch for hours and hours and hours. And, yeah, but I wanted to be a professional basketball player.
At what age did you realize that that wasn't going to happen?
I think I always knew. Birth? No, probably around 13 or 14 when I got into high school and I started seeing what other 14-year-olds physically were. You know, I entered high school, I was like 5'2", 150 pounds. When I graduated, I was 5'7", 170 pounds. So I grew 3 or 4 inches and I gained 30 pounds. So I saw what a real physically, and these weren't even kids who would end up going anywhere professionally. These were just the best kids in my neighborhood and outside of my neighborhood, and what they were. I mean, kids 6'3", 6'4", dunking at 14 years old. I never had a shot.
I'm not sure that you have this word in English, but we have something called like ball sense, that you are good with balls, basically.
We don't have that word, but I like it.
Yeah. Are you?
I have it.
Gifted, yeah.
Yes. Yes. I have good coordination, I guess, is how. I was always pretty decent at every sport. I was never great at one sport, but I could play every sport rather well. And I'm super competitive, so where what I lack physically, I think I kind of made up for with like determination and just.
And the competitiveness, does it come from having an older brother or?
Definitely does. Yeah. Although he never played sports. To this day, him and I argue over everything. And I'm just, and again, he is not athletic at all. He's more cars and that kind of stuff. I don't know how to change the oil in a car. He doesn't know the first, like he couldn't tell you who played shortstop on the New York Yankees for 15 years. Like he doesn't know who Derek Jeter is.
Me neither.
But if you lived in New York, like if you don't know who Derek Jeter is, like you should be imprisoned. That's how they felt. Me, I could, like if I had a flat tire, I'd call him. So,
but on the other hand, we don't have baseball at all in Sweden.
At all. See, that's, yeah. That's true.
But what's the beauty of that sport?
The beauty of and why it's like America's pastime is it was kind of always the sport that was the easiest to understand for younger kids. So it was very easy for fathers then to, that was usually the first sport a young kid would pick up. It was either soccer or baseball for the most part. And I think it became America's pastime because a kid would start to learn about baseball, and then a father or mother for that instance, but a father would take the kid to their first baseball game. And when you see your first baseball game live as a kid, I mean, it is the coolest thing in the world to see. So that's kind of become the tradition of it. And that's why it's become America's pastime, although it's not America's number one sport anymore.
Okay.
Football is America's number one sport by a lot.
And you are a Yankees fan?
I am, yes.
Okay. What about Dodgers? Do you sort of like them? Or
I sort of like them because, you know, they're not competitive with the Yankees. They're in a different division altogether. So okay. They were not, although they were rivals, you know, when like my grandfather was a kid, because the Dodgers used to be from Brooklyn. They were the Brooklyn Dodgers, and then they got uprooted and moved to LA. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I have a soft spot for the Dodgers, you know, for the, I like all LA teams, although I don't publicly root and endorse. Like secretly, I like when LA teams are good because it's good for the city, and this is the city I live in.
Okay, cool. So it's all right that I buy sort of Dodgers stuff for my son, even though I'm not.
Absolutely, yeah. All right. Absolutely, okay.
I love their merch.
Yeah, they have good merch.
Yeah.
Good colors, simple, exactly. Blue and white.
Yeah. When was the first time that you were on stage?
You know, I didn't discover acting until my freshman year in college. I was always obsessed with movies and television. Still am to this day. They used to have something called Sunday Matinee, which is how you used to have to, if you didn't see a movie in theaters back in the day, you'd have to wait for it to come on television a year or two later. And my grandfather, who I'm named after, he was a very, I'm not going to say like rough, but like he wasn't the warmest guy in the world. Now, granted, he was the greatest grandfather. Like, he took care. He was the patriarch, took care of everyone.
And this is your father.
My mom's father. Okay, like, sorry. When I turned 13, I went to go give him a hug and a kiss, and he stopped me, and he said, "How old are you now?" And I said, 13. He said, "We do this now," and he extended his hand for a handshake. He was that kind of guy. Not really, didn't really show emotions ever.
Okay.
But when he would watch these Sunday matinees, and after dinner on Sundays, I'd go watch, I would hear him yell at the TV, he would laugh, he would get upset. Like, I saw emotion from him, and I thought, wow, like, this is the thing that makes him show these emotions that I can't make him show. Or, like, he had four granddaughters, no one could make him show. Like, this is a pretty powerful thing. Yeah. So that's where I really started loving movies and television. But when I went to college, I was already done with school in my mind, you know, and I was trying to figure out what to do with my life. And I'd taken an acting class because I had heard the teacher gave you an A just for participating and showing up. Didn't matter if you did the work or not, just come, show up, and you get an A. And I went, and I participated, and I really started to fall in love with it. And I really thought that this might be something I wanted to explore. And the teacher didn't give me an A. He actually failed me. And I remember asking him, like, what are you doing? Like, you're giving kids in here who aren't doing anything A's, and you give me an F. And he said, well, that's because I actually think that you have talent, and I want you to come back and take the class again. And I did. And that was the first time, you know, we'd put plays on. So that was the first time I ever really did like a performance in front of an audience. And that the rush, like, that was drugs for me. I knew right there. I'm like, I have to figure out a way to do this for the rest of my life.
Did you have a plan? Because first there was sports
right.
up until like early teens.
Yes.
And at the age of
what? This is like this is 18, 19.
What were your sort of goals in between?
Clueless.
But you're supposed to be, right?
Yeah, I was at that stage where I guess a lot of kids are, where I'm starting college and it's like, what am I going to do with the rest of my life? I didn't really have, outside of sports to that moment, I didn't have a passion of like, oh, I want to be in law enforcement, or I want to be a fireman or a dentist or a law. I didn't have any of that. I was just trying to figure out like, wow, what am I going to do with the rest of my life?
But did you have a major in college?
I didn't get far enough, really.
Okay.
I guess liberal arts, which basically uses the word liberal for real. Like, it's kind of, liberal arts is kind of like, you don't really know what you want to do. Like, it could be maybe writing, it could be acting, it could be sociology. There's a lot of things that went into liberal arts.
Yeah. You said that you did plays and so forth. Was it like Shakespeare and all that?
It started, like, we had one phase where we had to learn all that stuff. And that stuff, while I enjoy watching it, is not the kind of stuff I'm interested in doing, because I just don't think I'm very good at it, obviously. I don't have that muscle. But when we started doing stuff like Death of the Salesman and another play, which I did on a bigger forum called Enter Laughing, which was very off Broadway. It was like above a restaurant. But also, that's where a talent agent saw me, and that's what helped get me to L.A. So,
is that when you sort of was discovered?
I guess you could say that, yeah. I also did this other thing. It's called the IMTA, right? And it's basically, I forget what it stands for, but it's almost like this convention where it's like a competition where you do scene study. You know, you do like a scene from a sitcom, you do a dramatic monologue, a comedic monologue, and you have 8 real agents and managers are judging you. And you could win awards and stuff, but also, if you didn't win an award, if they thought you had talent, you could have a meeting with them. It sounds like a scam, and I actually thought it was a scam, for sure. And I think it is a scam to a degree, because if you have the money, you're in. There's no, like, oh, you don't have the talent, sorry. If you have your money, you're in. But a lot of people have come out of that, believe it or not. I think, like, Katie Holmes did it. I think Ashton Kutcher did it. I did it. And, that's kind of where I met my first manager, who said, come to L.A., I would love to work with you, I could get you a lot of auditions. And there was a weird time going on in, like, film and television, and this is 99. It was all teen-based. This was, like, Scream and Dawson's Creek and all the, like, every, it was the craze. That's all you, it sounded like they were giving shows and movies away to, like, kids at the mall. Like, hey, you, come be on TV. And I looked really young at that point. I was 18 or 19. I looked like I was 13 still. Didn't have facial hair. I still had, like, chubby cheeks. And I moved to L.A. January of 2000. I had just turned 20. And I was going on 12 auditions a week. Didn't book anything.
Oh, you didn't?
Nothing.
Okay, but it didn't take that long, did it?
I guess if you really reflect on it now, no. Because from the time I came here to the time Entourage happened, it was 3 years, which is not a lot of time. But to me, in that moment, it felt like an eternity. You know, I worked at every restaurant in the Valley, as we were talking about early, and had all sorts of odd jobs and had the crummy apartment. I didn't have a car my first 2 years in L.A., which is like being on the moon without oxygen. Like, how do you live in L.A. without a car? I was taking the bus.
Okay, you were.
Yeah, fantastic. And those are the kind of things where, like, if you missed your bus, you don't catch the next one 15 minutes later. You catch the next one 2 hours later, because it came every 2 hours.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it took me 3 years to get Entourage and kind of start my real career, but that felt like an eternity at the time.
How do you get that job?
That job...
I guess you've told this story
before. No, but... yes and no. You know, like, I mean, I had to go audition and fight and scrap for it, but it was actually an independent film that I did, which is the first movie I actually did. And a lot of people in the cast went on to do some great things. An actor named James Badge Dell was in there. Who he's got about 40 movies coming out. Max Greenfield, who's on New Girl and is one of my best. We've been best friends since then. Was in it, and it did well. Like it was a $400,000 movie, coming of age story. Did well at film festivals. It didn't get a wide release, but Steve Levinson, who is my manager now, who is the executive producer of Entourage, represents Mark Wahlberg. Saw me in it and thought I'd be signed me, and then also said, hey, we got this show on HBO called Entourage. You should audition for this role. I remember reading this script initially, like Turtle. I was like, what is this? I didn't know anything about life as a movie star. So I was learning about it as well as I was reading it. I'm like, private jets? Like, why does this character want a private plane so bad? That's ridiculous. Mm. And then, yeah, I probably auditioned for it 20 times. They start pairing you up with different people, all leading to the final test, they call it, okay. where HBO obviously gets the final say. And that is the most stressful thing in an actor's life, testing for a show.
They 20 basically, times.
Over the course of 6 months, yes, but then it all leads to this final day. And they basically bring like 3-4 actors for every part, and you sit in this big, kind of, it's like you do your auditions in a theater, but you're in this big waiting room with everyone. You're staring across the way. I'm like, oh, there are the Turtles. There's the Johnny Dramas. There, and you're looking at these guys, and it's like, wow, it's going to be one of us. Yeah. One of us is going to get this today. It's the final day. And I remember you do your individual auditions first, and then they start pairing you up. And then they also start letting people go home. So you start to see like, all right, it's like, it's almost like American Idol in a way. It's getting thinned out. You're waiting for that golden ticket. And I did my first solo audition, and I don't know if I was nervous or I didn't kill it. I wasn't great. And I went outside in the room and I was a little bummed out, and I'm waiting. And Mark Wahlberg, who I had not met obviously, and was still a little intimidated by, it's Mark Wahlberg, you know?
Yeah, of course.
I was still a meathead from Brooklyn. And he comes out of the room and he's pointing at someone. And I realized, like, he's pointing at me, and he's like motioning me over. He's like, Jerry, come here, come here. I'm like, oh my God, I'm getting called into the principal's office. I walk over, he puts his arm around me. He's like, buddy, what are you doing? I'm like, what? He's like, listen, he's like, that didn't go too well in there. I'm like, oh, I didn't. He's like, no. He's like, look, I watched all your audition tapes. He's like, you are this guy. He's like, don't worry about the script. Don't worry about the people in the room. Just go do what you've been doing. Go kill everyone. What he meant by that is like, go just steal it. Go do it. He kind of gave me this amazing pep talk. And then next I went in, I think I got paired up with Kevin Connolly, who was E all these years. And him and I just went in, and from the first line either of us spoke, the audience laughed. And the HBO executives, it's almost like they know not to laugh. Like they don't want to give you any idea if you're doing well or not. And him, Kevin and I had this great read together. We went outside, and then everyone slowly starts getting sent home. And then finally it was me, Kevin Connolly, Kevin Dillon, and Adrian Grenier wasn't there. It was someone else. Adrian had sent the tape in from New York, but it was 3 out of 4. Everyone else had gone home. We kind of looked at each other like, all right, this is it. And I got the phone call an hour later.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Who knew? Yeah. We didn't know then that it...
But it sounds like it was like sort of, it was big already. I mean, if you had been to that many auditions and so forth, they knew that it wasn't going to be something major, right?
Well, that's the great thing about, I mean, there's many great things about HBO, but especially back then, because there wasn't as many cable platforms. I don't even think Showtime was really, I think Showtime was just starting to do shows. Obviously, there was no Netflix or AMC yet. So when HBO, you know, they may have 100 shows in development, but when they choose one to make, they really give it every chance possible to succeed. Whereas if we were on network TV, our numbers were like okay in the beginning. We probably would have gotten canceled because we weren't a runaway hit from the first moment of airing. It certainly took some time. And like I said, that's HBO believed in the potential of where this show, they saw 3 or 4 years down the road of what this show could be. And they let us figure it out, Whereas I think on other platforms, they would have given us the hook.
You've been to Europe quite recently.
I was just recently.
In Sweden, I'm not sure that it ever aired.
Is that right?
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I don't think so, but everybody saw it. You know, Pirate Bay is from Sweden.
Right.
So I'm sorry about that.
No. In a weird way, like, yeah, believe me, I don't love piracy and all that it stands for, but I am glad that you saw it, you know, and people in Sweden saw it. So I'm not saying I condone it, but in the same breath, you know, it's better than almost never seeing it.
Yeah, of course.
But also, yeah, like when we were maybe halfway through or three quarters of the way through with our run, that's also where, you know, the internet was basically becoming this real thing where people could watch stuff. So
of course,
that's why we never really truly knew how many people were watching, because we knew people were watching from many different areas.
It must have been like it's one of the most, I mean, global hits of that decade.
Yeah, you know, again, I never really traveled much, so I didn't know. And we did do an episode in France at the Cannes Film Festival. Yeah. And that was the first time, I think that was like season 4. That was the first time we've obviously left the States. That was the first time I left the country ever. And you go to, you know, a foreign language where you don't speak the language, but yet people knew. People were starting to, they would kind of spot us and they would know us from the show. And that's where we started to think, oh, maybe this thing is a little more global than any of us think, you know?
How was like moving around in Europe then, now, when you were there?
You know, it was tough. Like London was really tough because we had a premiere in London and the show...
You were sick, right?
Yeah. Yes. Of all the premiere, we've always had great premieres over the years. New York was always like the really big one because our families were there. LA was definitely a trendy one. So far, London may have been the best premiere we've ever had. Like, it just was an amazing venue, the way the fans showed up. No, we couldn't basically go anywhere. I've always heard in Australia the show was huge.
Okay.
A lot of Australians want to run up to me and wrestle and hug and...
Have you been to Australia?
No, I've never been. Adrian's been.
Okay.
And said it was great. And Adrian, actually, after we're done with London, me and my girlfriend and Kevin Connolly and Doug, we went to Italy. Adrian went to Stockholm.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
I know.
You know? Yeah.
Yeah.
I like your watch, by the way.
Oh, thank you. I saw that you're a Rolexer yourself.
Yeah, it's like a new obsession, which accountants don't love. Watches are just exploding again. Like, the prices are pretty crazy. I'm looking at one now that I want, and it's just like 6 months ago, it's gone up like 25-30% in like the last 6 months.
What is it?
I want to get the black and blue GMT.
Okay.
They call it like the Pepsi Cola like the Batman one. Yeah. I just think that's a beautiful watch.
Is it just Rolex for you, or are you a
Pepsi? No, I like, I like them all. I have an AP, which I really like. I had a Panerai, which I like. I actually I sold to get another watch, and like, though, I don't know what's happened to Panerai, but they've really taken a hit. They've kind of I sold, and then it went down. Like, I lost some money on it when I sold it, and then it went down even more after I sold it. I don't know. I have no idea. I think maybe they made too many of them. I'm not quite sure what's going on with Panerai, but you know how it goes. It's all a cycle. They'll come back because they hit like a high point like 3 or 4 years ago, I think, because David Beckham started wearing them in a few photo shoots and stuff. And then there's a massive rush on Panerai.
Is he big here? Is it?
Yeah, he certainly.
He still lives in LA, right?
Yeah, no, he's certainly a household name here for sure. People love Beckham. I'm a Beckham fan here. He comes into. I have a, I won't call it a restaurant business, but a sandwich shop business, and yeah, he frequents the Hollywood location with his kids all the time.
Ah, that's nice.
Yeah.
Okay. So he also goes to SoulCycle, mm-hmm. I know.
Yes, he does.
Have you tried that?
Yeah, I'm not much for it. It actually, it hurts my knees. I know it's not supposed to, but my girl does it a lot. I'm not a big spin class person.
No.
It's a great workout.
Well, I've been there once to SoulCycle. Beckham wasn't there. I'm very
the
sorry
one right
that.
Up here. West Hot the
one on Sunset.
Yeah. That's the one.
And I was sort of blown away about the atmosphere in there. It was crazy.
Sure, a lot of beautiful people in there as well. Yeah.
But now that the Entourage launch is over, what does your everyday life look like?
You know, right now, I mean, in the exact current state, and I, it's weird because I've had a little, the last few weeks I've been a little hard on myself because I'm finding myself, I'm not like lacking in motivation, like I'm certainly motivated, but I really am only motivated for certain things. Like the window of things I'm motivated for is shrunk in a way, and I think partly because the Entourage press campaign was so massive. And it really didn't match up because the movie wasn't massive budgetarily. Like, it wasn't a big budget movie, but we had this, like, 2-3 month campaign. Like, you thought we were, like, the Avengers. We were everywhere.
Yeah.
And that part of the business I'm not great with, you know? Like, the whole selling a movie. Like, I know how to promote stuff, but I didn't realize... I'd never been on a press tour for 3 months. I've done the 2 or 3 week junkets for a movie and stuff like that. And it kind of wiped me out and... I've been back now for, you know, we were in Europe 2 months ago, so I've certainly had time to recover, but I'm still not really ready to take on much responsibility yet. And it was weird because after the show ended, I was so motivated in, you know, the what's next. And I'd done 6 or 7 movies in between the show ending and Entourage. Mm-hmm. And it was a hard time not to commit to Entourage, like I didn't want to do it, but I knew doing Entourage was kind of all the work I had done to kind of get out of that role, not in an ungrateful way, just in an evolutionary way.
Of course.
I knew I was gonna not take steps backwards, but it was gonna shut down my life for a while. I there's 2 great jobs I couldn't do because of Entourage, but Entourage in itself was a great job too. I was never not gonna do the Entourage movie, but I just knew, okay, even in great success or in failure or in mediocrity, I'm going to have to kind of start over again in breaking away from this character. And that's kind of where I am a little bit. I mean, you know, I have a movie coming out later this year and I'm on a show on the Stars Network now called Power. And those are all great opportunities, but I'm not quite ready to dive back in yet. I'm enjoying the podcast, man. I really love that because with acting, you get to control nothing. Like, sure, you can control all your performance, but I can't wake up tomorrow and say I want to act tomorrow. I have to go, after this, I'm going to audition for a Clint Eastwood movie.
Ah.
Small role, but I have to go scratch and claw and fight to even get a small role in a Clint Eastwood movie because that's just how it is. Like, you have to go earn it. And I'm not afraid to do that, but I do like that tomorrow I could wake up and if I have an idea for a podcast, I could go do it. I don't have to ask for permission.
It's fantastic.
Nice.
Yeah,
it's a nice feeling to be able to control an artistic form finally.
Yeah, of course. I mean, that must be so frustrating in a way because with acting, there's always going to be like 100 people that are sort of going to make decisions for you or whether you can do it or not and so forth.
Yeah, and the next thing I do if I have it my way, which that's also what I'm trying to do, like I would like to get back on television. Like I said, having done a few movies after Entourage, very grateful for it, but I don't know if going to New Orleans for 6 weeks and New Mexico for 3 and Vancouver for 2, you know, I don't know if in Atlanta for 2 months, like I'm a homebody. And especially now, I was talking earlier about maybe marriage and family. Like, I don't know if that's for me. There's something now about a television show, that daily grind, but the stability, almost like that's like the actor's version of a 9-to-5, really, is a TV show in LA. That sounds so good to me right now.
But are there any shows that are shot here?
Yes and no. Some are, most aren't. But what I was going to say is, you know, the next thing I do, if I'm afforded the luxury to do a television show one day, I want it to kind of be something that comes from my brain a little bit, that I have a hand in developing, because I do love writing. I wrote for Entourage. I wrote 2 episodes of the show, and I spent 2 years in the writer's room. Writing is also a passion of mine, you know? And it goes back to the stuff with my grandfather. Like, acting was kind of what I first discovered, but I could have easily been an editor. I could have been a writer. I could have been something in movies and TV is what I wanted. And acting was just the first thing I discovered.
Yeah.
But now I'm discovering other things that are equally as challenging and exciting.
Yeah, but that's fantastic, because in the writer's room, nobody's going to associate you with Turtle.
No, people still don't know that, you know, I wrote some of the episode, and they're kind of not shocked by it, but they do like, oh, wow.
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool. Like, they never really, oh, I guess they didn't expect it, because perception a lot of the times here and in the entertainment business is reality. Like, they see the backwards hat and the pot smoking. And, oh, that's Turtle. That's what he does. And if they only knew, they only knew.
Yeah. I started my podcast in a way to sort of, I was hoping perhaps that I would get more jobs in television, like perhaps being a producer or an editor or whatever. But I was thinking that maybe you had sort of the same drive with your podcast, or...
You know, it was a few things. Number one, I've always had a love also for radio.
Plus one, yeah.
Yeah, and this kind of dates back to sports. You know, I didn't have a TV. It's so weird. It all goes back to what we were talking about. You know, single mom. I didn't have like the big TV in my bedroom and all that. Like, I had a radio, and I would like always listen to like the Yankee game on the radio, and then I would fall asleep to talk radio. It's just my first form of entertainment, really. And so I've always loved it. And then, like, you know, I discovered Howard Stern at a young age and other radio hosts. So there was that, the fact that I always had a passion for it. And yeah, like you said, it's not that I wanted people to see another side of me, but maybe subconsciously I did. Like, if you listen to my podcast, I think you'd find it surprising to learn some stuff about me. And it really was just also about showcasing people who entertain me, that I think that are extremely entertaining and funny, that maybe don't have a massive following that I think should. Like a buddy of mine, Kevin Christie, who's a comedian, and Brett Ernst, who's a comedian, and a guy like Max Greenfield, to hear his story, you know, and see the differences of him and Schmidt. I don't know. That's also part of it for me. And also, you know, my girlfriend's the producer. She has a education in journalism. Like, she... I always knew she'd be good at it, you know? I don't even think she really knew at first. And I couldn't do it without her. And she's absolutely great at it.
When it comes to podcasting, then, who got you into that?
It was just really from being a fan, you know, of listening to, you know, listening to guys like Bill Burr and Joe Rogan and stuff like that here. And then realizing...
Mark Maron?
Mark Maron, of course, yeah. You know? And, you know, I think him having Obama on his podcast really... is going, that's just sending it into another stratosphere now. Like, it's official. We could talk about the golden age of podcasting. That took it from gold to platinum, you know?
Exactly. Well,
it's good for all of us.
Yeah, Serial took it to gold then.
For sure. Yeah. Serial took it to gold. Marin took it to platinum. And I think...
But there is going to be more. I mean, there's going to be Titanium as well, or whatever. I mean...
Yeah, I mean, we've been doing it for a little over a year. And from the year I started, I habitually like to check the iTunes charts, because I'm a competitive son of a bitch, and like just seeing the amount of new shows from when we started, and I really didn't know just how easy it was. When I say easy, I don't mean the actual content part, I mean just the technical part. You know, I didn't know it was that easy to do. I mean, easy for me, it drove my girlfriend nuts figuring out how to get an RSS feed into it, like all that, which I don't speak that language, she does. To me, it seems easy. I go tape a show, and then she puts her magic fingers on it, and then an hour later, it's up for whoever wants to hear it. I think it's so cool.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
Yeah.
And I've realized that it was the first... I mean, you are probably too young to have been a punk rocker, but do you remember it happening?
Oh, I certainly do. You know, I wasn't obviously around for the beginnings, but, you know, I was around, like, Nirvana took it to a whole other level. And I also am a bit of a historian. I produced a documentary about a punk rock group in the 70s, a band called Death, which not a lot of people knew their story, but a lot of people who are around punk rock from the beginning knew about Death. So it's kind of like, I get what you're saying about the movement, just how it's taking over.
Yeah. That's what I feel with podcasting, is that it's the first punk movement that I'm actually in. And it's fantastic.
It's true, right? Yeah, you're absolutely right. I never really thought of it like that, but that's a great way to think about it.
Yeah, everybody can do it. And obviously, yeah.
Well, that's very cool. I've gotten a lot of emails. I like audience interaction. I really try to interact with however many listeners we have, but there's probably been 3 or 4 cases of people who started their own, even on a smaller scale, just from listening to mine. And I think that's like the coolest thing in the world to me.
Yeah, it is.
I've never inspired anyone to do anything.
Well, I'm sure you have. But anyway, do you consider it like being a part of your job, or is it more of a hobby?
That is a great question, because, you know, we are monetizing it on a very small scale, so I guess it does become part of a job, but it really, in my heart of hearts, feels like a hobby to me, because that's how much I love doing it. Like, I don't ever, maybe there's been 1 or 2 times if we've ever had like an aggressive schedule where we're taping maybe like 3 or 4 in a week that I'm like, this feels like a job right now. But it never really quite feels like a job. But I do think it is part of, I look at my career and people's career in general as like the sum of all parts. It's not so much about the one big, I don't ever want to be just the one big thing. Like, Entourage will probably always be that thing for me, whether I like it or not. You know, I never really had like a publicist or any of that stuff before I recently started working with one, because I just always felt I didn't have enough to talk about. But if you kind of add up now the sum of all parts, like obviously you and I, we could talk Entourage. We could talk Fat Sal's if we want. We could talk weight loss and stuff. We could talk podcasting. It's all that. That's how I want to be defined, by everything, the sum of all parts, not just like one thing.
But I was thinking about that, because you said on your podcast which questions you always got to answer during the Entourage launch. I'm not sure, have I asked any of them so far?
The ones that I've been, that, yeah, exactly. You've definitely...
I'll try to keep away from it.
No, we'll, you've done it. Because there are there's the 5 basic questions. You know, it's like, what was it like bringing Entourage from a TV show to a movie? How has Turtle evolved? Is it as much fun as it was? You know, and I appreciate all those questions. But yes, in the last 3 months, I've probably answered them 1,700 times.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's people doing their job.
Well, yeah, but lazily.
I didn't want to take it that far, but you're absolutely right. Like, I always start every podcast, I do my work, and I find myself doing the same thing. Like, how could I not ask Jerry O'Connell about Stand By Me, you know, which was his first role as a child actor. Like, it's one of my favorite movies. Yeah. But he's been asked that his whole life. But I certainly had that on my list of questions when he came in. He's a friend of mine. So the minute I started going that route, he literally diverted from the plan and said, let me tell you about a story where I thought I had AIDS. And I was like, what? I'm like, no, dude, it's the story. And he's like, no, you're going to love this story. And the episode went on for 2 hours, and I never once looked at my paper. And I kind of talked to him afterwards. He's like, no one wants to hear me talk about Stand By Me. That's available on thousands of outlets. Like, this is the shit people want to hear. And while I don't fully agree, because I still want to hear about Stand By Me,
but
I get it. I almost did to him what people have done to me, and it's hard not to.
But you
to
have
go
to.
With that.
You just have to sort of do a little soul searching,
and a little research.
Yeah, exactly, and try to find a spin of your own of it.
I completely agree. You know, like we were talking about Brooklyn. Not a lot of people, and I'm not even sure this is an interesting point to ever talk about or not. But I've done a lot of podcasts too. It's nice to be a guest. I like not driving the car, you know, but rarely people want to talk about Brooklyn or what it was like to grow up there or my dad. Like, I've gone basically my whole career not fully ever discussing my father. And while I'm completely happy about that, because I'm always waiting for that question, you know, it's maybe come up like twice.
Yeah, right.
Which tells me people didn't really do tons of research.
Yeah, perhaps, or out of respect in a way.
Oh, no, for sure. Like, years ago, I went on like Rosie O'Donnell's talk show, and she had asked about like my single mom, and she was like, "Oh, what happened with your parents' divorce?" I'm like, "Oh no, my father passed away," and she kind of went, "Oh, how?" And I just was like, that's what came out. I was like, I didn't know how to, I didn't want to talk about it. And then she felt horrible. She didn't know the can, she wasn't trying to pry. She just didn't realize. You're right. A lot of it's out of respect. I'm not saying people should ask me that, but,
How did it die?
No, it was drug related.
Ah, okay.
And, it was the sort of thing I always, when I was younger, even before acting or anything like that, I always was not ashamed to say, but I thought people would associate me with that and like judge me. And it took me growing up and becoming a man, an adult, to realize that people don't look at things like that. People don't really, maybe some do, but most people just look at it like a tragedy and say, oh, that must have been horrible. But I had the best childhood in the world, and having one parent was the most normal thing to me ever. Like, I felt bad for some of my friends who had to like get over on two parents.
Yeah,
it's like, oh, you had like two hurdles to get past. I only have one.
There are presidential candidates who are for legalization of all drugs, right?
I don't know if it's all. Definitely complete and total legalization of marijuana. I mean, it's almost, that's already happening, you know? I think some are.
But I mean, having lost your father, do you have an opinion on that?
I do, and it might be hypocritical because I was affected, so I'm not saying that this is how it should be, but I really despise drugs, you know, it's taken from me. So it's hard for me to look at them and be like, oh, everyone live your life how you choose. Like I don't, and my friends have always done a really good job. I don't think any of my friends do drugs. And if they did, I don't know. Like even growing up, I mean, look, and this is where I'm a hypocrite because I don't look at weed. I look at alcohol as more dangerous than weed.
It probably is, yeah.
But weed is a drug, so I guess I'm a hypocrite by default right there, you know? Although I don't smoke anymore, I smoked weed for years and years and years. So, well, like I said,
caffeine is a drug as well.
Yeah, right. But I don't know. I've seen what it's done to people. I've seen what it's taken from me. And it gets into your body, and then your body just craves it. So it becomes one thing where you're making a choice, but then it becomes a thing where your body is calling for it. I don't know. Drugs like cocaine or whatever, I'm sure a lot of people might hear this and tell me to get off my high horse. Like, I don't know. I don't like what it does to people, man. I'm sure people who are doing it don't know at the time what they look like, but it's hard for me to accept. It really, and I guess if I am preachy and if I have one deal breaker, is like I just don't associate with people really intimately who do hard drugs. But again, the hypocritical part of me is I'll sit and drink with you. I'll sit and you smoke a joint right now. I wouldn't care. So I am a hypocrite.
Well, it's complicated for me because I understand why there are people that want to legalize or decriminalize the use of such substances, because you don't want to punish people for being victims of and so forth.
Right, but then you don't punish the people who use it, but you just want to punish the people who sell it. Honestly, I'm grateful I am not responsible for any of these decisions that go on, because I wouldn't know the first thing or the first way to actually make this normal in any way. Like, I'm still freaked out by the fact that weed's legal and you could walk into a shop. It's just ironic because I don't smoke anymore that now I could be smoking. Like, the way I used to have to go buy weed to how it is today, it's not fair.
I'm curious about one thing about weed, is that when you drive like on the 101 or whatever, you're gonna smell pot on the highway. Do people smoke in their cars while driving?
You know, I don't think so. I don't think you could. That's a great question that I actually don't know the answer to. Because, I mean, to me, it'd be the same thing as drinking and driving.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's tough, man. I feel for people who've struggled with any form of an addiction. And it's a very addictive thing. Look, by the way, I get it. Even like with the way I used to smoke weed and stuff, like I get it. I love to escape. Life is hard. Escaping is very easy to do. I think that was a lot of my dad's issue, was just escapism. Like, I don't want to face my problems soberly. So I don't look at it like people who use drugs are idiots. I feel for them in a way. And I just hate that, I hate that term rock bottom. And that's usually when people start to clean up their lives. Like, oh, he or she hasn't hit rock bottom yet. It's like, oh, I wish it didn't have to get to rock bottom, because rock bottom is such a scary place, but I guess that's sometimes what it takes for people to make that turnaround. But I love a good turnaround story.
Of course. Did you ever smoke real pot on set on Entourage?
You know, I get asked that not a lot every Sorry. Now. No. That's not a frequent question.
Okay.
But the answer is no. I'm not going to say I never. Here's what I'll say. I never have with Entourage. Pre-Entourage, I maybe messed around. But, you know, those work days are so long that at least for me making like the choice. Because obviously, I know how to play stoned from weed very easily. So I never felt like I needed that to portray it accurately. But also, I knew if I did that, this 14-hour day is going to turn into a 16-hour day. I'm going to be stumbling on my lines. And, you know, do you want to work when you smoke like that? Like, yeah, maybe for an hour. But then at some point, it would kind of hurt you. So no.
It looks really real. I mean, how do you fake that? Because you can't smoke regular cigarettes.
No, they have like this. Well, when I used to smoke cigarettes, I would just roll regular tobacco in papers and just kind of smoke it. Then when I stopped smoking cigarettes, I would use like this herbal tobacco, which looks like weed. And even just the art, even just inhaling a cigarette like a joint, I could feel like I could kind of trick myself into those mechanisms. It's one of my favorite shots ever in the history of the show for me, which was an episode we did about like the first legal weed dispensary, and the Johnny Drama character just wants a hat from the store. And I'm just like, oh my God, we got to get pounds of weed. And he gets me some good weed and he calls me because he needs it for something. And I'm just sitting on the couch, like hitting this giant joint and there's smoke everywhere. And I'm like, yo. Because I just remember, like, that's how my friends would. I could tell when I would call my friends when I was younger, if they answered the phone, like, yo. I knew they were just stoned out of their mind. So it wasn't that hard to play.
I understand. Do you consider yourself an entrepreneur?
Yes and no. Yes, because I've done well with some businesses outside of Entourage. So I guess by default I am. But no, because I don't seek out. You know, I'm not like mini Mark Cuban going on Shark Tank. I'm not seeking out like, oh, you got a great business. Let me help you go public. I'm not really seeking out businesses, but I do enjoy getting into other areas. Like we talked about, you know, I have the sandwich shop and the podcast, and I do have a real estate investment with my uncle back in Brooklyn, in Williamsburg, of all places. We have a big building that we just built there that he's had for years that we totally knocked down and rebuilt. And just seeing how that property's increased in the last 5 years is, I guess, makes me an entrepreneur. But again, like I said, it's kind of by default. I'm not seeking these things out. And I've had a lot of great guidance from my older brother and this uncle I speak of. They've been in business for a while.
What does your brother do for a living?
My brother's in real estate as well. He's a part of the Williamsburg thing, and he has his own real estate business in Staten Island and in Brooklyn and in Manhattan. You know, so he's my best friend. He's kind of... It's weird. He hasn't been like a father to me, but in a weird way, he has been without me knowing it. You know, like he's been, him and my uncle are the only two male figures that I will listen to. I have problems with male authority. There's my daddy issues. Those are the only two that could literally yell or tell me what to do and I'll listen.
How about your agent then?
Nope. Okay. No, not. I mean, I listen to them because they're smart, but in terms of like feeling like I have to listen to them, I only really tolerate from those two. But I guess you could say I'm an entrepreneur by default. Like I said, I don't search out businesses.
But when Googling you, it says that your net worth is like $5 million or something like that.
Is that right?
I think so, yeah.
Maybe you should Google that again. I'm kidding. Look, obviously, my life financially was changed by Entourage first and foremost, but these other things have certainly, and I'm only able to do those other things because of Entourage financially,
Do you splurge?
You know, that's my thing. Like, I am fortunate in another area. The things I like to do don't happen to cost a lot of money. I mean, they do when you look at them relatively, but I love to play basketball, I love to work out, I like to travel a little. I'm not a big car guy. Watches are probably my biggest splurges, and I don't have any form of gold, anything. Watches are a big splurge, and my house where I live. Like, I'm a homebody, so I like to have a nice place to hang my hat. I like a nice watch and a nice steak. Those are my biggest expenses probably in the world.
Okay. Do you have a heated pool?
No, actually, I have a pool, not heated.
Okay.
I don't feel the need. It's so freaking hot. Yeah. I just don't feel... My pool's like 88 degrees with no heater.
Okay. But not in the winter.
No, that's going to be a problem.
Yeah. Okay. But you just moved in, or...?
Yeah, recently. Like that's what I was saying, like, going back to the laziness part and me not being motivated, I moved into this house, which, you know, it's a very nice house. I haven't really been... I've now been home for, like, 5 weeks, so I finally feel like I actually live there.
Okay, cool. Congratulations, I guess.
Thank you.
Are you also marrying your producer?
I want to, but although, you know, I guess that's on me, because what did the kids say? Put a ring on it? I haven't done that yet. I mean, I know for sure, like, and I've told her this, like, if it's not her, it's nobody. Like, if we can't make it work... And if I can't make it work with her, I really don't think that there's anyone out there for me, because she is the most compatible person I have ever seen in my life. I'm extremely lucky to have her. I always say to her, like, even when we do nothing, like, even if we sit home and watch a movie or, like, go for a walk, like, I feel like I did something. Like, people ask me, oh, what'd you do last night? I'm like, oh, me and Bree sat on the couch and watched The Godfather. They're like, oh, so you stayed in. You didn't do... No, it was a great night. I always feel like we did something.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
You told me about this fantasy camp, but do you do other charities as well?
Yeah, I mean, I don't have my own charity that I am associated with. It's something I do want to do one day, and I'm going to do it. And I think my mom's actually going to help me with it, because she always felt that mental health is something that needs more attention. But I mean, a lot of my friends have charities. I've helped with Mark Wahlberg's over the years, and I'm always donating to various ones. Like, there was this woman who writes for, I think, the television show Bob's Burgers. Wendy, I don't know how to pronounce her last name, so she's probably going to be mad at me, but she had this whole charity thing where the hook was, it's Cure Search is the name of her charity, and she says, there's two things I hate in the world: children's cancer and Entourage. So help me fight both. Like, if you don't... So her whole charity was, you donate money, I'll go watch Entourage, and, like, I'll write a review. If we get to, like, $20,000, I'll watch it twice. And all this great... I actually thought it was really funny. So I donated to it, like, to put her over the edge to have to see it. And I just told her, I was like, well, here you go, Wendy. Enjoy the movie. Like, I just really thought it was a unique way to promote a charity. I totally got the sense of humor of it. Of course, her reviews were scathing, but I don't know. I just thought it was funny. I'm also helping right now with this one that's really unique, and it's these two kids who started a Kickstarter to help kind of support and encourage female skateboarding, which, you know, obviously doesn't hit home with a lot of people in terms like stuff like cancer and a lot of medical things. And but I don't know, I saw the way these two kids are kind of doing something that doesn't benefit them, it's benefiting someone else. So I just felt, and Bree, my girlfriend, is the one who kind of showed me this, and I thought they were really creative kids with the way they shot some of the stuff. And you don't really hear about female skateboarders. You know they're out there. You know, I don't know if they feel like they're glossed over or not. I just thought it was a really cool thing, and I'm going to donate a little bit of money, and I've talked about them on the podcast, and I'm tweeting about them. I don't know. It's the easiest thing to do to me. And I think we could all do – it doesn't have to be a major thing. You don't have to have money to do it. I don't know. I just think charity is something that makes this world a much better place.
Agree. What do you know about your future?
What do I know?
Yeah.
What do you mean? Be more specific.
What do you have planned ahead, and what do you want to do? I mean, you're a goal guy.
If I had it my way, it would probably be to get back on a cable show that I am also helping to produce and write, that I'm acting. It doesn't have to be a starring role, but it's not just, I want to put my own hat in the ring. I want to take a dive with my own ideas. Mm. Some in LA, so I could set my home life up.
You have ideas for that?
Yes, I do. Okay. That's what I mean. Like, I'm a little lacking in motivation. I'm staring at these ideas I have on the board, and I just need to just go at them a little more full forced. And I will. It's kind of like my process, because then when I do, I am completely OCD. I will do it morning, noon, and night until it's done. So I think that's part of it too. Like, I'm enjoying being lazy, because I know once I go in, I'm not coming out till it's done. Obviously, marriage and children, you know, growing up without a dad, like, that's very important to me, being a father.
There was a rumor on the internet that you already knocked her up.
Really?
Yeah.
Did you find that?
Yeah.
That's a real thing. Not true, but I would like to disprove.
No, but I can show you.
Is that true?
Yes.
Oh, the internet. The wild, wild web. No, that is certainly a rumor. I've heard only a couple. There's only been a couple of, like, outrageous rumors about me. I'm lucky in the sense where I am not nearly visible and famous enough to get, like, some of the crazy, wild rumors.
Huh. Wait. This is, like, August 5. That's now, right?
That's today. I gotta call my girlfriend. Oh my God, I'm having a baby. No, that I don't even know what that is.
Okay.
There was a rumor on the internet years ago that I died.
Uh-huh. Okay.
That was interesting.
Yeah.
To, like, start seeing, like, why is my mom calling me? Why is my brother calling me? Why is my everyone I knew was calling me within the same hour? I'm like, guys, what's going on? They're like, there's a rumor on the internet you're dead. I'm like, well, I'm not. Otherwise, I mean, and that's what you thought, to call me?
Yeah.
I guess that's, like, the thing. And what, if I didn't answer the phone, you'd assume the rumors were true?
Yeah, I guess so. How else are they going to check it?
I guess, right?
Yeah, I mean.
But no, to my knowledge, we are not expecting.
Okay.
But to answer your previous question, yes, that's something that I would like to see myself do. And then I think eventually it would be to move back a little closer to home. You know, her family's from Ohio. Mine's from New York. That's actually a pretty good point. They're only about an hour flight from each other. The idea of living somewhere quiet, like Ohio, but some people think you're, oh, what are you, nuts? Like, to me, actually sounds pretty cool. Uh-huh. And then you could do a pot. Like, you want the end goal. Do a show for 7 years. Hopefully make some more good money. Have the kids. And then, you know, just move. Just go off into the sunset. Be done with acting. Move somewhere far away. And then do a podcast out of my man cave that hopefully has millions of listeners. And do that twice a week and play some golf. Done. I'm happy.
How is your golf?
Horrible. I quit.
Oh, you did?
But I quit and I start playing again and I love it and then I quit. It's a cycle. I've quit golf probably more times than I've actually done any other sport in my life.
Okay.
Yeah. I usually break a club.
All right.
And then when that club's getting fixed, I quit. But then when that club comes back repaired, it's like, maybe I should start playing again.
Yeah. Would you like to recommend something?
I'm going to recommend something, and this is really nerdy, and some people might hear this and say, I thought this guy was so much cooler. Okay, I've recently started doing, like, these, like, weird dinner theater things. They're usually, like, murder mystery dinner theater, which I'm a total, like, my favorite movie of all time for that genre is Clue, and that's my favorite board game, and I love that whole, like, murder mystery thing. And there's some places that do it in, like, a dinner theater environment, and it's actually just really, there's, like, great performances, there's a great story, you're part of the show. So wherever you live, just Google your local murder mystery dinner theater, see what comes up, and go try something new. I did one that was on a boat one time. It usually takes my birthday for me to get my friends to do it with me. That's the only time, because they have to do what I say. Other than that, I don't ever get to do it. So my birthday is coming up in November. I'm going to do it again. It'll be like 4 years in a row that I've gone and done murder mystery dinner theater. It sounds stupid. I know. You could lie. You're making a face. I don't know you or not.
We don't have it in Sweden.
Maybe that's what we do. That's another thing I'd love to do. I'd love to produce my own, like, seasonal, like, summers only, like a murder mystery dinner theater event where you're part of the show.
Fantastic.
Yeah, I'm
yeah,
sure
you should make a franchise.
My next entrepreneurship.
Exactly. All right. Good luck with that.
I feel like your audience is wildly disappointed with my thing that I chose to talk about.
No, I'm sure they're not. Who do you think I should interview?
Ronda Rousey. You know who Ronda Rousey is?
Yes, I saw the movie.
And because you've done a really great job at not asking the traditional questions, and I feel like Rhonda's at a point where she's getting those traditional questions, she's just a great interview. I think you'd enjoy it. I had her on maybe like a year ago, and she is so candid and so honest. And it's just a great interview. It's just a great interview. And I think she's at such a unbelievable point in her career. You talk about someone who's skyrocketing globally at that. I think she'd be a great, I think you'd love to have her on.
Thank you very much for your time.
Of course.
Jerry Ferrara, such a nice guy. And he talked about that Clint Eastwood movie that he was auditioning for. He got it. It's called Sully. It's going to come out next year. It's got Tom Hanks. It's got Laura Linney. It's going to be a big one, I guess. And Jerry Ferrara is in it. Fantastic. Congratulations on that. And you can also see Jerry in a TV series called Power. I haven't seen that yet. I'm not sure that we have it in Sweden. I'll try to check it out when I go to the US next time, or try to find it on the internet some way. All right. That's it for this week. Lovisa Olsson is the editor of Varvet International. I'm Christoph Triumph. Talk to you in 2 weeks. Take care of each other. Bye-bye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.